Good morning. My name is Mike Gibble, and obviously I'm from the University of Oklahoma. There's Oklahoma State University, too. My talk is about the use of social constructionism in tobacco policy and advocacy. And in recent years, several tobacco control and public health scholars in various different journals have posted and published various articles using social construction and postmodernism as a way to explain tobacco control advocacy and policy. And examples of this in recent times have been news media analyses, use of images and stories in advocacy. There have been a variety of those. Smoking depicted in movies, and the Philip Morris support of FDA regulation of tobacco as a form of corporate reimaging. So, let's go into a little bit of a primer about what is social constructionism. It's an extremely interesting and probably an entire course in and of itself, but I will give a broad overview. Later on at the end of this talk, there is an article coming out, a peer-reviewed article, and there'll be a site for that which gets into much more detail about this. But primarily, it's a philosophical approach that focuses on metaphors, symbols, stories, and discourse. Each metaphor or story is socially constructed from a particular point of view. So for instance, in recent times, one construction of the tobacco industry is that it's been a pariah industry. It's supposed to be denormalized and so forth. This is a socially constructed image of what this industry is all about. Social constructionism and metaphoric reasoning is directly linked with the more recent postmodernist philosophy of Michel Foucault and Derrida and others. Postmodernists argue that all reality and knowledge is textual, relative, symbolic, metaphoric, and contradictory in orientation. They argue that there is really no universal paradigm of power. This has been attacked from the political left and right, by the way, people who think there are universal truths in politics and economics. Political education and advocacy occurs in a variety of localized venues. Any exercise of power at the higher level can be locally resisted, locally, or deconstructed. Hence, one of the features of local tobacco control advocacy in the last 20 years is to approach this from the local point of view, what are local governments doing for smoke-free policies and so forth. And as I mentioned, one of the major frames behind tobacco control research is the denormalization of the industry as a pariah or social menace. This has been going on for about 15 or 20 years. And the argument is that by doing this, politicians will support more stringent tobacco control regulation and taxes in terms of policy, such as clean indoor air or so forth. However, here's the big caveat. And in fact, the first speaker pointed this out very eloquently, I thought, with the model and the theory that he had at the beginning of his talk. There are other approaches to understanding tobacco control and education. Most of them come from not outside of public health, but in fields of social science, sociology, political science, anthropology, and so forth. There's a laundry list there of the types of things that scholars have published outside of the journals of public health. That's not to say that some of this stuff has also appeared in public health journals as well, but predominantly this is appearing outside of public health journals, which is something I think we should all think about, why one approach seems to be occurring in public health journals and why one approach seems to be occurring in other journals. So things like what is the influence of subnational units of government, that is local government, on state policy for clean indoor air policy? How does policy diffuse between levels of government? In other words, if one state like California enacts a very strong law, will this diffuse to another state around the country or not? And or not is an important question. Policies impacted by political culture. What is, you know, we just heard a couple of talks about how political culture is very important, rural versus urban areas and so forth, in terms of how people will enact policies and politicians and so forth. political ideology. Does it matter whether you're an extreme conservative, a Tea Partier, a liberal, a moderate, a socialist, or whatever, a green, in terms of enacting these sorts of policies? The answer, by the way, is yes. Influence of social movements and interest groups on enactment. Elections. Obviously, elections can have a big role depending on who's in office. Bureaucratic implementation. What's the role of an agency to implement stringent and vigorous policies? So in some places, there are some very good bureaucratic activism, in other places, not so good. And finally, what's the role of capitalism and the profit motive in terms of all of this? Obviously, at the bottom line of all this, the cigarette industry is in the business to make money and please their shareholders. Another recent explanation for tobacco control policy is social policy realism. That model, I think, was also basically explained in the first talk, but this is my take on it. It focuses on what government actions occur or do not occur by executive, legislative, and judicial branches. Reality is not just based on one factor. Reality is complex. Social constructionism is only one explanation of how things work. And everything is complex, as I mentioned. So there's a whole list of things that could impact tobacco control policy, a lot of what this other research has been talking about, such as ideology and culture and so forth, social movements, interest groups. So I was very interested in this whole topic because I think it has some very important ramifications for education, advocacy, and how we shape and think about how tobacco control advocacy can and should occur. So I looked at the question of how or why Philip Morris supported FDA, as everybody probably knows here, regulation of tobacco, which was passed into federal, signed by Obama just recently and passed into federal legislation. One of the silent partners in this, besides all the myriad of health groups, was the Philip Morris Corporation. Why? What was Philip Morris's motivation for this? Well, one explanation of this appeared in the journal Tobacco Control, and it was basically along the lines of a social constructionist kind of an explanation. And basically, the primary factor in this article by McDaniel and Malone, and the site by that article is down at the bottom if anybody's interested. And if you don't catch it, I'll be up here for a while so I can give you the site later on. But at any rate, they argue that the primary motive for this whole effort was for Philip Morris to repackage its unfavorable or denormalized image as a corporate entity. Secondary reasons were tied to primary, included reasonable regulations to stabilize the market. That is, not every state should be passing their own regulations. That was very costly to the company. And allowing FDA the right to approve supposedly safer or less risky cigarettes, which is a whole other interesting topic. So in this research, I reviewed the tobacco industry documents from 2000 to 2007 that are online. Both the best site is UCSF, by the way, at their library, American Legacy. And I also focused on the primary motivation of Philip Morris. But I'm a scholar that believes you need to triangulate your data. Just looking at the documents does not tell the entire story. You need to look at other sources and cross-check what you are looking at to make sure that what you're looking at is accurate. So I used a variety of other sources, newspaper articles, peer-reviewed articles, government reports, federal court documents. And this is what I found. In August of 1995, FDA issued a proposed rule to regulate cigarettes as a drug or medical device. In 2000, the United States Supreme Court, Brown and Williamson versus FDA, et al. Versus FDA, ruled FDA had no authority to regulate tobacco. This is what sort of precipitated the whole business about why we need to have FDA federal regulation of tobacco, because there was no legal authority. 1999, Philip Morris began lobbying for FDA regulation of tobacco. Strange, huh? Core principles for Philip Morris's support of FDA regulation included tobacco harm reduction through so-called less risky cigarettes. I transparency. I personally think you cannot get such a thing, but that's a whole nother topic. Criteria to regulate design and performance of cigarettes, youth prevention programs, no adverse harm to U.S. tobacco jobs and sales, and no ban of tobacco products for adult consumption. That last one is the bottom line. In fact, it's the corporate bottom line. So in 2004, 2005, and 2008, and then later, a little later on, it continued. There were bills introduced in Congress to regulate tobacco products. And the key provision was of this FDA regulation was the reduction or elimination of harmful ingredients, or so-called reduction. We still have not, we still do not have epidemiological data that proves that's possible, but we will see. The key document noted, the key 2003 document noted why PM ultimately supported FDA regulation. I will quote the last part. You can hopefully read the first part. Cigarettes are a unique product and play a complex role in our society. Despite their intended dangers, cigarettes are consuming by more than 40 million adults. The industry generates millions of jobs and billions of dollars in revenue annually for all levels of government, unquote. However, the key document, and it was the kicker that got this article, peer-reviewed article published, which I'm going to give you the cite for in a second, was Philip Morris's playbook. It was in the tobacco documents in 2001. It was this lobbying book for Congress. And it was very thick and it was very comprehensive, obviously, because they needed to know what to do to save their cigarette market. Pretty self-evident. And it provided their motivations for this whole effort. It was quite interesting. Stability in business, profits and sales, and with the federal government, including repairing its image as a rogue industry. So that was a secondary factor. It was not the primary factor, though. Certainty in business goals and profits with respect to responsible marketing and reduced risk products, uniform ingredient and testing disclosure, standards for defining less risky cigarettes, which, by the way, the biggest cigarette on the market is Marlboro, and they have the largest market share. So getting a less risky cigarette by a competitor on the market is going to be very difficult. Uniform standards for ingredient disclosure, and federal law that preempts conflicting state standards. It was a political economy approach. It was basically designed to stabilize their market. Rogue industries and rebranding was secondary to the primary directive, as they say in Star Trek. Conclusion. Primary motivation for Philip Morris's support of FDA regulation was not an effort to repackage its image, period. It was not. Primary motivation was market stability and private profits. I mean, this really shouldn't be too much of a surprise if you really think about it, what they were after. They wanted this implemented through the United States administrative process by FDA. It was paramount in meeting these profitability goals that they get the anti-tobacco advocates and everybody else off their backs on this subject. Litigators, sympathetic legislators, this was all in the document. Hostile regulatory agencies. And this would occur through national legislation with federal preemption of conflicting and costly state regulations, which did occur, by the way. Repackaging image with secondary goal tied to maintaining profits. So I would recommend that a research and health education model that emerges in this case is to explain tobacco control policy, or perhaps all policy, but that needs to be researched further, based on social policy realism or the complexity model that we saw in the first topic, and not primarily on social constructionism or postmodernism as it has been published in a variety of public health journals in recent years. A complex set of interrelated factors tied to private profit was ultimately what was behind all of this. And if you think about it, this is sort of a postscript. If you think about it, reality is complex. Why wouldn't this be so? So here's the details on the forthcoming article. It's coming out in the Journal of Policy Practices in March of next year. I just did the galley proof. You got the broad talk about it. It will get into a lot more detail and so forth when the article comes out. And if anybody wants to contact me. There I am on my email circuit, and I'm open to questions. Yes. There's no doubt that this whole question of imaging is important, but it's one of many important factors, and I would hold that primarily that's all directed towards maintaining the cigarette market. Yeah. Else?
Thank you.